Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 4th of October. Connie Kilmark is going to join us in just one moment. First, I have one announcement to make, and that's that we are in a pledge-free day today, thanks to the more than 800 listeners. Actually, it's way up to 1,460 listeners who gave us today off. We only need another 140 listeners to take tomorrow off. So let's, 131 now. All right, good. 131, that's great. So nine of you called last hour. Pledge now if you can, and then we're off tomorrow. So let me make this brief and give you the website, WPR.org, or the phone number, which is 800-747-7444. 131 pledges left. We ought to be able to do that and then take off tomorrow, too. Ooh-wee, that's good. Connie Kilmark is our guest this hour. And Connie's going to help us with money. She has a very unique style. She's developed an approach to personal money management which balances the emotional and psychological aspects of money with financial facts. She served as a counselor and then director of the Madison Consumer Credit Counseling Service back in 1975, and then in 1986 founded her own counseling and consulting firm, Kilmark & Associates, which is based in Madison. She deals with all kinds of issues, personal money management, consumer debt, consumer protection, psychologically sensitive investment strategies. She has a special interest in the psychology of entrepreneurship and the dynamics of money in the family business. And during this time when so many of us are being hit by incomes that aren't going up, by furlough days, by lack of jobs, the unemployment rate is very, very high. We are worried about our pensions. Some of them have gone away. Student debt, how in the world do you pay for what you owe when you get out of college? And there aren't as many jobs as there should be for those of you who have gone through the whole college 4 years or beyond. Credit cards, all of that, it's on the table for Connie. And here's our phone number for you to join the conversation with her, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address for Connie is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hello, Connie. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Tell me, Connie, you run into more of these people because they need your advice, but it seems to me as though the number of people who are hurting in terms of having to pay student debt, in terms of having lost some of their investments when it comes to retirement, in terms of making ends meet because either you don't have a job or you've had your wages cut or they're not going anywhere, we're all kind of hurting, aren't we?
Every single demographic has its own woes in this economy. And as a result, we're seeing people not leaving jobs that have jobs, even though they want to retire or take a chance and move somewhere else. Houses aren't selling. The scandal with both our national lack of investment in higher education and the resulting huge industry that developed in the last 15, 20 years over student indebtedness, which, of course, is tied to a provision from a recent bankruptcy reform in 2005, not allowing these students out of these debts, even when they are private loans, so that they are forever shackled to these debts, sometimes $30,000, $40,000, $60,000, $100,000. These are huge issues, and so many schools are beginning, and ours is not a stranger to this. Many universities and small community colleges are beginning to more intensively look at financial literacy early enough to actually make a difference and have students begin to think about what they're doing before it's already completely done. Now, when you borrow student loan money, Kathleen, you're very young, and you're outside by a condition of the student loan almost. You're not in the workforce. You're in school, and that's what you're going to use the money for. And as a result, the loan that you're taking out isn't really going to become real for you for years in many cases. It's very, very heartbreaking to watch students say, oh, my gosh, if I had known what this was adding up to and what it would mean,
right,
It's instead of a house. It's instead of a car. I have to pay this. So it's a very big issue.
It is a very big issue. And what about people who are on the other end, people who are about to retire? You mentioned them just a few moments ago.
Absolutely.
You've also said that most Americans are underprepared for their older years, and they're way underprepared, I think. And a lot of people
That's
have
right.
lost a lot of money recently.
Well, I think we have to do a fundamental recalculation. It's interesting to me that the people who are the least prepared actually have a slightly funny little response. They say, well, at least since I don't have a portfolio, I didn't lose anything. But the ones who have been trying and now have lost quite a bit in terms of what that portfolio's value was, we really have to think again because, first of all, we're living longer. And we can't think of our late 60s as if they were our parents' or grandparents' late 60s, where they would have been on the very edge of their last years. We're living, in some cases, 20 and sometimes 30 years past that. So I've been talking a lot in community presentations about the fact that our nutrition, our exercise, our healthful habits are also retirement investments, because we simply will be working longer. Every year that you can sustainably bring in a wage is a year that you don't have to draw out of whatever your savings. And if you can delay Social Security, generally that's a wise idea unless you have a very strong family history of an early death or a serious, serious health problem.
And for many people, they're probably a little bit happier, too, if they work, right? I mean, you have
Indeed.
To admit it.
Indeed. You know, retirement is this word like a giant steamer trunk. We should do a show on this sometime. What does it actually bring up for you? Does it mean you unplug completely? Does it mean that you're free to do more of what you want to do and less of what you have to do? Does it mean that you stop working? Does it mean that you become a community volunteer? I think there's no power on earth stronger than a determined older person who has nothing to lose, who wants to make a social difference. So from my perspective, there's a force of retired people or people nearing retirement
Yes.
who nothing on earth can stop if that's what they decide to do with their retirement. So I think there's lots to be unpacked in that mysterious word retirement. We may end up with having preconceptions that are based on maybe ancestors that were coal miners or manual laborers whose bodies wore out. And many of us are not in that particular situation.
Right. And somebody has yet to figure out how to take that force and channel it into all the schools that need help and environmental work that needs done.
That's right.
There needs to be a system in place to do all of that, I think.
You know, among the things that are happening as a result of this economy are two things that I've noticed. People are hesitating to commit to relationships and
mm-hmm.
marriage. And you may have noticed an article recently in the New York Times where if one person in a deep personal relationship has a significant debt, many thousands of dollars, maybe school loans, maybe credit cards, it could be any number of things. When in the relationship do you reveal that? And what happens if that revelation disrupts the notion of that relationship? And that brings me to the notion that in relationships, people are like sovereign countries. Each one of us is almost like a little country with a written constitution in some cases, but more often a tacit or behavioral constitution. And when we begin to date or when we begin to feel very close to someone and think about possibly marrying that person or becoming very committed and sharing a household, in a sense, we need to review both our written and tacit constitutions of values, of preferences, of habits, things like, you know, how important is charitable giving? How important is performing arts? What are we going to do about food? How about our schedule of sleep and wake? All kinds of things have to be, in a sense, reviewed. And then a new constitution needs to be written, the constitution of us, the merger of these two nations into a new nation. That doesn't mean that those two people disappear into that relationship. It means that there needs to be some form of covenant that allows each to be the self at the same time as there is something shared. And nowhere in any subject matter of a couple's life is it more important than to get the money values straight. Besides picking your parents really well to teach you good values, you can't make, and of course we don't get to pick our parents, you can't make a more important decision that influences your future financial well-being more extremely than in the picking of your partner.
Mm-hmm. And what are these stories? We read them in the Times over the weekend that the marriage age is really going up fairly significantly. People are living together now rather than getting married,
right?
Particularly for people who maybe don't have terrific incomes. Does that make sense to live together? And what are the financial problems that are delaying the marriage age?
Well, the interesting thing to me is that preceding that article, those articles, which I didn't see over this particular weekend, I did. There's been recently a very interesting magazine article in the Times talking about a new stage of adult development, the 20s, as being fundamentally different than even 50 or 60 years ago. That the 20s are like a phase of hesitation at the brink of adulthood. It seems as if the 20s are a time when people are saying, I don't want you to expect me to be a complete grown-up just yet. I'm not sure what I want to commit to. And as a result, the 20s, which used to be the golden time for marriages, seems to be a time where people want to keep their options open. And in an economy like this, that actually makes a certain amount of sense. If there isn't solid employment, and if there isn't a decent sense of a future for an economic certainty, the idea of having children, for instance, would seem premature before you get that straightened around. So it isn't surprising, given how much longer we're living, and given this new sort of awareness that we're in a globally competitive environment, which was surely not true when you and I were young, Kathleen. You know, when you and I were coming out of high school, Germany and Japan were still flattened from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't a globally competitive, you know, good math majors and engineers from every country in the world. You know, now we're in an environment where these young people are coming out competing with every nation, and some of them very successfully.
Right. And still, though, in order to move into the area of being able to get married and have children, it seems what we're also reading is that getting a college education is even more important.
That's right.
It is now, isn't it?
And, you know, the thing is, it isn't necessarily even what you study. I worry very much that colleges are becoming technical schools, vocational schools, because people are so concerned about the job afterwards. I want to register my deep vote for the liberal arts in that I think the ability to think, the ability to keep your promises, the ability to know how to find out about a wide variety of fields continues to be a crucial set of skills. Those abilities that you can explore so widely in those first 4 years, or 2 years even, before you commit to a major that may in fact be more along a vocational line, that seems crucially important in a time where change is happening so fast that your ability to regroup and think on your feet in a variety of disciplines seems a really wise investment.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. Getting back to, I want you to spend a little more time talking about money and relationships, these sovereign countries, and mm-hmm. determining your money values. I guess that it's something that really gets a lot of people deeply in trouble, right? And it's something that don't talk about how much you make and don't talk about religion. Some of that, even though it was advice for many, many years ago,
yeah.
People have adhered to at their own detriment, to their own detriment.
You know, it's probably the most, many people think of it as the most unromantic thing you could possibly do.
Right, of course.
But for so many years, marriage was not seen as a romantic, primarily romantic emotional thing. It was indeed a condition contracted between families and sometimes between political units for very strategic purposes. I'm not advocating that we go back to arranged marriages, although they have a surprising and in some cases striking success rate.
There is a show.
Yeah,
okay.
There you go. I mean, really, because the families already have similar backgrounds and they have, you know, there's a lot that is sort of pre-cleared for being in common. But it is incredibly hard to talk to two people who are deeply in love about the fact that talking clearly about even a prenuptial agreement, a covenant, a constitution, a general set of guiding principles, check these things out, talk about how they are going to go. Primarily, Kathleen, because a good date doesn't necessarily make a good mate. Some of the people that are delightful to be with for an evening or a weekend or even a year may not be the people that are good for the long haul of real life.
Mm-hmm. Connie Kilmark is our guest, and we're going to welcome phone calls for her. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@WPR.org. And we're talking broadly about relationships and money. That encompasses so many things. So many of you I know are hurting now because of the times in which we find ourselves. And we're talking about our retirement and our early life plans and saving for college and credit cards and trying to get through. What kinds of skills do you build in order to make it in this economy? And we're talking to Connie about all of that and how it affects us emotionally, because of course it does. To your calls momentarily, I want to just remind you that we're enjoying a pledge-free day today, thanks to many of you who called for, and now we have a day off. We've had 1,000, well, we've had more than this because we had pledges last hour. We need just 121. All right, 121 more pledges in order to take off tomorrow, which would be terrific. Because one of our guests tomorrow is Julian Zelizer, who's a great talker and has written a book about Jimmy Carter, and you'll want to hear a whole hour on that. So make it happen by pledging today instead of when you might pledge tomorrow. WPR.org or 800-747-7444. They'll take your pledge there, too. Okay? Calls for Connie in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our phone calls with Boyd from Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen. Hello to your guest.
Hi, Boyd.
This is such a great show. It really hits home a lot with what I've been having to deal with. Just to get to the point, a couple things. The past year, I had to, unfortunately, file for bankruptcy because of an auto accident the previous year, and I didn't have auto insurance. It went through, and that's the good news. The other good news is I did a few months ago receive not a huge amount, but a windfall from that the government owed me some money, and I used it to put money down on a new apartment, and I have the rest in savings, and I have talked with a financial planner about investing some of it in mutual funds. I guess the thing is right now, though, I still have a little bit of debt out there that I wasn't able to file. And I'm gradually trying to get things back in order. I have my own place again. But on top of that, trying to get things from dental work done and invest in a computer for some medical design I want to do, and then eventually get a car. How would I prioritize all that? I mean, the last thing I would get would be an automobile, and I'd get it used just because I know they're not really an investment.
I think that's a good observation. Cars are expenses, and I think you're a relatively young person. You're in front of maybe 10 cars in your life, so you want to see those as capital investments or capital expenditures that are going to decay and depreciate. So as soon as you buy one, start saving for the next one, for heaven's sakes. That's a long list of priorities, and frankly, I'm very conservative these days. I'm very interested in keeping some cash cushion even more aggressively available than I was before. When you say you put some money down on an apartment, can I imagine that that's a rental? Is that correct?
It is a rental,
okay,
yes.
Okay, so you put a security deposit down, and now you're going from shared quarters with somebody who was doing you kind of a favor to now being a person who has an independent dwelling. Is that true?
Yes, I was living with my sister for a few months in Wauwatosa while I was regrouping, and I work at the airport. My job security is good, and I decided I wanted to live near the airport so I wouldn't have to rely on public transport or everything, so I'm a 10-minute walk from the airport. That's why I picked the location I did.
I love the fact that you're tying your dwelling and your workplace
yeah,
together.
Yeah, that's great.
I think that's incredibly economical. I would still be very careful. I would be thinking about, with your dental work, it gets more expensive the longer you wait. With a computer, as far as that goes, even reconditioned ones can be more useful than whatever it is that you may have now. As far as the car goes, I would agree with you. If you can walk to work, you can, in fact, delay that purchase as long as possible, and the walk will be excellent exercise for you. I would be not sacrificing all of my savings, no matter how important these priorities are. Taking care of the continuing to exist debt, if there is not an urgent legal reason why you need to do that, I would take it slow and pay it a little at a time instead of dumping some of that precious cash on it.
Thank you, Boyd, so much for your call, and all the best to you. Jim on the road. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Jim.
How you doing? I just have a quick question. I have a daughter with a finance degree who's dating a guy for a couple years who's at the opposite end of the fiduciary responsibility spectrum. And I do not know how to advise her on the problem she's going to, because he's not going to change. It's obvious.
Well, it's probably one of the most worrisome indicators, but, you know, try to talk to somebody who's in that hormonal stage of love, and it's really difficult. The reason that I say how I talk about how important it is for them to talk about this, and phone calls, by the way, at my office are free. To begin with, a phone call doesn't cost anybody anything, so they might want to just call and find out a little bit about this. They'll get 20 minutes, half an hour for no cost. It's the biggest single indicator of their well-being in the future. And honestly, if it's annoying now, occasionally annoying now, in the midst of, you know, we're 5 years in, there are two children, one of us has lost his job or her job, the romance, the lubrication of that hormonal stage of romance is gone. I think it's very important to say, who you are is who you probably are going to be. Interestingly, two people like the gentleman that you're describing can be quite happy together because they're not pulling in opposite directions. So two people who are perhaps poor money managers, they can be in bankruptcy, but they'll be quite happy because they won't be pulling in two different directions and tearing each other apart. It's when you have that 180-degree division that you're going to end up with a parent-child marriage. The one, maybe your daughter, will become parental. He will become the acting-out teenager who's being judged and corrected all the time. This is deeply anti-erotic. It is not a good foundation for intimacy in a relationship. So I encourage them to talk this through.
Is it unusual for people who have wildly different ideas about money to get married to each other?
Not at all.
In fact,
it's so common because the more methodical person is attracted often by the spontaneity
right.
and the pizzazz of uh-huh. that person who's more of a free spirit. The free spirit, I sometimes say, is sort of like a helium balloon that sometimes needs to be tied down with a little sandbag. And so that person can also be attracted by how organized the other person may be, meeting deadlines, making plans, you know, kind of keeping things in order. The attraction is very understandable. It's just that in the details of everyday life, there needs to be, it's not impossible to work. They need a constitution. They need a set of understandings, and they need some awareness of how these two different styles play out over time and how to protect some of that security in the common ground.
Thank you, Jim, for your call. We have lines open now if you want to join the conversation with Connie Kilmark, 800-486-8655. Email. Nobody's used that yet this hour. You could do that. talk@wpr.org. Chris in Oshkosh. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, hello. Good morning.
Hi, Chris.
Great conversation this morning. I guess I'm just calling in regarding, I guess I disagree a bit about the education statements you guys had before. I'm currently in a relationship. My girlfriend just graduated college and has about $50,000 in loan debt. And, you know, unfortunately, she calls a degree kind of a useless degree, you know, and it's she's working a $10 job, an hour job, and really going to have a struggle paying her back over time.
Right.
And it sort of seems like I kind of see it as like our new national crisis, where we're getting students. Every student grows up believing they have to go to college, and I almost feel like there should be more of a technical college push to, like, you know, pretty much, you know, instead of getting our youth jobs or getting our youth degrees, more we need degrees that are more like the future jobs of our country. We need to kind of steer our kids in the direction of, you know, when they get out of college, there could be either the, you know, opportunities that are going to be there for you. And maybe, you know, it seems like when they do cuts to education, they always want to take out the career counselors. Well, you know, looking back, I wish I had some career counselors that would have talked to me some more and said, hey, you know.
What's her degree, Chris, what's her degree in?
Well, I don't have a degree. I'm now driving truck and racing cars. It's kind of a different career path. I'm just an odd guy, I guess, in some ways. But
What's your girlfriend doing? What's her degree in?
Oh, what was that? Could you repeat that? I'm sorry.
Yeah, we got a lot of noise here.
Oh, psychology.
Psychology.
Yeah.
All right, Connie, take it on.
So it's a very interesting question. You would enjoy an article that was, again, I hate to keep saying the New York Times, but there was a really interesting article that was called about a year ago, The Case for Working with Your Hands. This is a digested form of a book by Matthew Crawford, a guy with a PhD from the University of Chicago in political philosophy, I think, who restores vintage motorcycles in a business of his own. And he says, our country may have made a wrong turn a while back when we decided that all the smart people would have clean hands and white shirts, and all the not-so-bright people would be working with their hands and perhaps having dirty hands. He says that's a false dichotomy. It takes an incredible kind of intelligence to make things work and to understand the larger systems that make things like plumbing and electrician work and mechanics work. And as a result, we have undervalued consistently and maybe even lost a group of people who much prefer to be the doing persons, the kinesthetic learners that have to have their hands on something in order to do that learning. So I can hear the truck motoring down the highway, and you can't outsource trucking. So I would agree to some degree that there is a real undervaluing of our vocational schools as an alternative path, and even an accompanying path as the psychology degree turns into a very interesting conversation, but not necessarily an immediate job skill.
Mm-hmm.
So the $50,000 to me is the tragedy here, because a general degree with a price tag that large, with the optimism of youth saying, of course, when I finish, I'll be able to pay this back, you don't really know when you're 18 and 19 years old the meaning of $50,000. You can't know it. And as a result, you only find out how it weighs in the balance.
Yes.
After you begin to have a paycheck and have to start looking at apartment rent and auto expense and insurances and so on. So you really don't know what you're doing, frankly, even though you're an adult and able to write your name on a contract.
And you can't do that on $10 an hour, can you?
Cannot be done, right.
So what does she do?
Well, there's going to be increasing emphasis on payment plans for student loans over a period of time that are codified according to the means to pay, because she can't do the student loan instead of eating. She has to be able to do it proportional to the wage. And as a result, there's going to that particular change has to happen, because there are and the amount of lending simply we have to look at this. We can't have students coming out of 4-year degrees with $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 worth of debt.
Right. Thanks, Chris, so much for the call. We go to Paul in Verona. Hello, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Paul.
Okay, how are you?
How are you? Oh, hello?
Yeah, hey, we're definitely here, Paul. Go ahead.
Okay. First of all, I agree everything you said about the education part. I have one child who's working on a PhD in physical therapy and the other who's in a tech college working in hotel management, and I think they're both going to have fulfilling, successful lives. So I think that you were right on the mark there.
Good.
Now, my comment, though, is I'm concerned on how, when we talk about retirement investments, how we infer that is actual money instead of potential money. And I was a very conservative investor. I did savings bonds and CDs into my 30s. Started getting a stock portfolio, worked with mutual funds and things like that. I've had two real-life lessons that tell me that's not real money. My daughter needed cancer treatment, and we had to cash in those stocks for medical bills. Yeah. One stock, we lost money. The other, we got basically 2% over 5 years. The second example is when my mother died, and she was a GM employee. Her stocks were worthless. Yeah, you could got statements that said, oh, yeah, you've got $150,000, but that was $150,000 in 1978. When she needed that money in 1990, it wasn't there. So I'm thinking we need to talk about you don't lose that money when the stock market goes up and down. You only lose it on the day you cash it in, or make it on the day you cash it in.
So that's a very good observation. The fact is that you have to be reviewing what you're doing in relationship to your age and your need. And it's another reason why that big, fat cash cushion is so critical. If you were in a significant amount of cash, now with the GM situation is a very specific situation, but if she were concentrated primarily and almost solely in one company's stock, even if it's a company that currently is booming, that lack of diversification is worrisome, even in the shank of the years when you're building, like in your 40s. I would say even then it's worrisome. But as you age, you're moving some of your money out of what you say, and you correctly say, is in your potential value, and you're moving it into greater certainty, so that as you age, more and more of the percentage of your distribution of assets is in a form, not 100% of it, because you don't need all of it, as you probably would agree. You don't need all of your savings on the same day as you start to draw Social Security. So, but you do need enough cash to ride out those unevennesses in the market and move into a time when perhaps things have had a chance to recover. That's the point of having things in a certain form of cash and cash equivalents, even and more so during your later years than in your younger years. You're right to say you haven't lost the money unless you've cashed or sold. This the same wisdom I'd like to impart to people that are in their homes. If you intended to live in that house for 10 or 15 or 20 more years, it honestly doesn't matter whether the house value goes up or down. Your home is a utility, and if the value of it has gone down, probably so has the value or the cost of any other replacement housing. So really, it only becomes an asset to your heirs, and it stays a placeholder for housing of some form pretty much through your whole life. So really, let's just calm down about house prices at the moment. It's benefiting the young home buyers that have never bought before. If they can save their money and get into a home right now, It's probably not bad. But home ownership, as we've now found out, is not for everyone. It comes with enormous attendant costs of taxes and maintenance, and it should not be portrayed as some sort of door to a golden future. It's a utility. It's a bathroom, a kitchen, some bedrooms, and a place to eat. It's a place to live.
If it has a dog. Just kidding.
If it has a dog.
If it has a dog.
Well, in that case, you need some vet savings, right, Kathleen?
That's right.
There you go.
There you
go. Talk about an emotionally driven expense.
Paul, thanks for the call. Here's a story that's come in via email. They choose to be anonymous. I dated and courted my wife of 25 years for 13 years prior to marriage.
Oh.
We made the agreement I would keep a roof over our heads and she would supply health insurance and food. We never combined checking accounts. Every quarter, as I am an excellent financial planner, I would ask her, how much is your credit card debt? And she would say, oh, it's small. After 22 years of marriage, I checked into her credit card records and found that she had $35,000 of outstanding debt and was paying nearly $500 a month of interest to keep it covered up. The total debt and interest over 22 years was nearly $70,000. We have held on, but it nearly ended the marriage, and he says it still may, given her lack of remorse and apology. See the statements and verify everything prior to a marital agreement. My wife is very hardworking, quality person, but she made a massive mistake and was too proud to admit it.
Well, you know, there you have it. The shame and the certainty of what the gentleman in this case would say if he were to see is so extreme. And when you start to cover and live a double life, there is a way in which I think it exacerbates what may already be a not-so-productive habit. But many people see the ability to use a credit card in an environment, in a retail environment, as an act of freedom. So if somebody like this gentleman says, you know, you just can't use these credit cards, it can sound like what he's saying is you're not allowed to make independent spending decisions.
Yeah.
I think it's so important to tease that apart and say what we want to agree on are some methods by which we're going to pay or own or save or expend. But we don't want to second guess or have to agree on every detail. I want to be able to buy the can opener of my choice or the shoes of my choice as long as what I'm not doing, and this is important in Wisconsin, as long as I'm not encumbering our relationship with a significant debt that in Wisconsin encumbers legally both partners to the marriage.
Yes.
Even though he doesn't know that those debts existed, he's bound by them. So if she were not able to pay them, he would be liable.
Yeah. And here's his FYI. I cleared up the problem in 48 hours. She will never have a credit card again as long as she's married to me. There's a lot in here. I couldn't even call into your show because it brings tears to my eyes as we're now paying for college at $20,000 a year, and all that money could have been used in that regard.
Yeah.
So
well,
it's...
and there's going to be long work on forgiveness and on figuring out how to retrieve a sense of faith to each other, because this is a little bit like having a financial affair, if you will. It can feel like a betrayal on that level for the person who's in this. And there isn't vocabulary, easy, ready vocabulary for working through this particular kind of issue.
Yeah. Connie Kilmark is our guest this hour, and she is, as you can tell, it has a real wonderful sense of money and relationship, and money is something that we're struggling with, many of us right now, many aspects of money. Should we get married? Do we have enough to retire? What about student loans? How do we pay that? And as you can see from that email, that it can figure into financial, I like Connie's phrase here, affairs as well. Connie founded her own Madison-based counseling and consulting firm, Kilmark & Associates, some years ago. She trains and speaks on personal money management, consumer debt, consumer protection, and psychologically sensitive investment strategies, with a special interest in the psychology of entrepreneurship and the dynamics of money in family businesses. Two more phone calls in a moment. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join us. And that number is 800-486-8655. The email, talk@wpr.org. We are enjoying a pledge-free day today, as you can tell, because our conversations are going on for a full hour. we hope to take tomorrow off, but we're about 121 pledges away from that, which means, oh, 112 pledges. Wow, we're moving along here. This is great. We're 112 pledges away from that, which means if you can pledge right now, then we could take tomorrow off if we get that many pledges during the course of today. It's entirely possible. Donate at WPR.org or 800-747-7444. I think we should do this every day. Wouldn't this be fun? We'll be a pledge away. Take a day off if you pledge today. This is good. All right, so we're getting close. More phone calls for Connie in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And our next phone call, Connie, is from George in Winneconne. Hi, George.
Hello. Couple of comments, if I may. You've had a wonderful financial advisor on the show many times, and he once talked about student debt, and he made the point that student debt can be very appropriate, and he outlined a way of spending cash in the first 2 years of savings and then borrowing your last 2 years, you know, to make sure you didn't build up interest. And I think in my past, I had a loan from Citibank. And if you borrow from a very reliable entity with the bank and look at the terms, not a credit card or some financial company, you can actually get great protection because they will readjust the loan if you run into problems. At least that's my experience. And the other thing was about, there are an awful lot of people that go on to do white paper jobs, I would call them, because of social class. That's the highest thing that correlates, and parents' education, that's the highest thing, the highest correlate with, you know, so-called success in later life. And there are many people in the past, especially, that were kind of streamed by negative characteristics, like they didn't like school, or they had trouble with English, or they may have some learning issue, but they were sent over to the vocational schools. Now, the fortunate part of that very unfortunate experience for many, well, the unfortunate is they didn't have real choices, maybe. But many have been brilliant. I've worked with people who have had no education and people who have had sixth grade education. And to give you just a story, when I worked with fishermen in Labrador, I was told that when they received outboard motors about 5 years, 4 years before, the first thing they did was take them apart. Know how to put them back together. And there are people like that everywhere. And we don't recognize them, and that's too bad. But often in particular interest groups, like fly fishing tires, gunsmiths, all kinds of ways this kind of genius really does come through.
Connie.
So in reverse order, first, I'm deeply, I like the appreciation for the inherent and incredible intelligence that it takes to understand how things work. I think that that's undervalued. And I think that because it's not made of words and computers, it's made of a different sort of awareness. We don't have a ready, I think we're reevaluating. You know, the plumber gets $80 an hour because he knows something that I don't know, and he knows it really well, and they add quality to our lives. The mechanical intelligence of people who are dealing with machines and with engines, the engine tells the truth. It doesn't work until you get the problem right and fix it. And that way, there's a moral or ethical dimension, a truth-telling dimension to this kind of work that I think has an inherent kind of honesty to it. I'm not complaining about student loan per se. I'm very concerned about the romantic way that students in their junior and senior year in high school are assaulted, especially when they're good students, by every kind of marketing piece that you can imagine from the glamorous schools. And parents can fall for this trap, that the glamorous school is the one that you ought to go to no matter what because it will indicate a better outcome for you. Know your student. Some students shouldn't even go to school when they're 18. They're not ready. And others ought to go to a less expensive place to just get their sea legs. It's an enormous change from high school to college. 50% of the freshmen that start at something like that at the University of Wisconsin-Madison don't finish. So we want to be sure that what you're doing is spending money intelligently, and if it's borrowed money, that there's some sort of considered, temperate plan behind it. doesn't mean you can know everything about what's going to happen to that youngster, but it's the size of the debt. And I think he's talking about Kevin McKinley, who comes on Joy Cardine's show on Tuesday mornings.
Mm-hmm.
I quite like Kevin's work. I listen to him as often as I can, and it's a very good show.
Thank you very much, George, for your call. Jane in New Berlin, hi.
Hi. I have a quick question. I know this probably is really dumb, but I was listening to the other caller or the earlier, and I'm divorced. I have a master's degree, but I quit my job so that my ex-husband could work his job and then ended up raising my children and then ended up getting divorced. I'm in my early 40s. And I've always worked. I don't mind working, but I'm not a career person. But this last year, I broke my ankle, and I've been out of work for 3 months. I can't walk well. I broke it very severely, so I was on non-weight-bearing status. I couldn't really walk, and I haven't been able to work. I'm on a leave of absence, and it's completely messed up my credit. So here's my question. In my early 40s, with debt, et cetera, but I'm pretty, so I have a chance to date.
You're pretty, did you say?
I am, and I'm just being, you don't know me, so I mean, but
it's
I
okay.
am, and I have a chance to date, but I feel weird because I have so much debt.
Mm.
And I feel like I should warn men, like, right when they I have all this debt. I just should tell them that.
Right.
So that I'm, like, in the process of actually getting a settlement, so I'm going to pay off, but it messed up my credit. It really did.
Well,
I think it's a
you know, some people don't say anything until after the marriage, and other people don't ask. You know, that would be a bad plan. But I think it's also not first date revelation material, because you don't necessarily even know whether you care about somebody until after things get a little bit farther along. So for heaven's sakes, use some common sense and slow down the revelation of the information. You don't need to put a mugshot sign under your chin before you even begin, because you don't know whether he might even have more debt than you do. So don't take for granted that because he's a guy and has a career that he doesn't have financial problems of his own. But a mutual transparency before marriage in Wisconsin especially is really, really important.
Yeah, and just remember, looks will get you a little ways, but then you get old, you know?
Right.
I don't think I've heard too many people say I'm pretty.
There you go.
Yeah. All right. Good for you, Jane.
It's an asset.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Katie in Madison. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
Hi, Katie.
I was calling. I'm in 26, married. My husband and I have a child, and we were kind of, when looking for a job, ended up part-time because obviously the economy made it so full-time was really hard for us to find. We just graduated college a couple years back. My question is, how do I find non-offensive ways to ask my husband to not spend beyond our means? He likes to buy a cup of coffee here or, you know, just little monies that add up, and I'm the one that does the finances because he did it and it got all messed up, and I said, okay, I'll take it back, but you have to listen to me. And
This is such a great question to end the show with. It's a great way of moving down into the grassroots of everyday life. I would say you can't scold him because he'll say, you can't tell me what to do. But you could do some simple arithmetic with him. You could say, you know, how much does a cup of coffee cost? This is the way I would do it in my office, but only if somebody's been is there voluntarily. And then tell me how much tax do you pay on that? And about how often in a week do you think you buy one? Is it like 5 times a week or twice a day? Is it like 10 times a week? Then you keep doing the arithmetic, starting with the smallest unit that you're sure of in terms of the price of a single cup. And if there's a little biscotti that comes with it, make sure you include that. These small things can feel to people like, it's impossible that this could threaten us because it's so small. McDonald's billions came from a very small profit margin on billions of hamburgers. The smallness is not the issue, it's the repetition. So, but you can't, he has to buy into this. And so as a result, it's a diplomatic challenge. And the more impatient you are, the more, almost like training, Kathleen, excuse this terrible analogy, it's almost like training your dog. You really, please don't everyone quote me on this, But you have to start slowly and make it enjoyable. There has to be a reward. In my office, I will say something outrageous. I sometimes say to a gentleman, if you begin to pay attention to her concerns concerning money, your sex life will improve. I guarantee it, and I never consult her first. And she always says, yes, it will.
Right.
So it's a very, it's an important subject, yeah. And it has erotic dimensions.
And on that note, we'll end. Connie, do you have a website?
I should have one. I will have one by the end of this year.
All right.
Kilmark
All right.
and Associates, 608-255-9500.
Okay, thanks, Connie.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Connie Kilmark, Kilmark and Associates, based in Madison. And we thank her for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production. Help us take tomorrow off, because we're supposed to start a pledge drive tomorrow, so go to WPR.org or 800-747-7444 for pledge-free mañana. We're going to be talking about the wave of gay teenagers committing suicide, such sad stories, the first hour of our program, and Jimmy Carter with Julian Zelizer, our number two. Thanks for listening.